Medic 43, District 1, Engine 51, response, cardiac arrest.
Hello, everybody. Welcome again to another edition of the MCHD Paramedic Podcast. This is Dr. Casey Patrick, and joining us today is our regular guest, Medical Director, Dr. Rob Dixon.
Good morning, Casey.
And today we're going to do a little bit of rehash, maybe reorganization. A lot of our best material here on the podcast, in my opinion, comes from our medics, our cases, our struggles and questions and problems and issues. And this one really sort of maybe irked me a little bit from the start. We had some new employees come through a 90-day meetup and touch point, and they said, "Hey, Chief Seek, Chief Campbell, we need some more EKG education." And I thought to myself, we have EKG education. There's some podcasts on EKGs. We did tachyarrhythmias not too terribly long ago in CE. And really, I thought, you know, we've got EKG education out there. What are they talking about? And like anything, you know, you get resistant, you get a little bristly, and then you step back and say, there's probably at least a pearl of truth in there. And so it's led me down the road of how we educate and how we talk about EKGs within EMS and really within emergency medicine. And from sort of aggravated to epiphany, really, is the actual progression of this.
Is that what happened to you? And then we were in my office, and he was very quiet, and he just attacked the whiteboard in this massive algorithm that came out of it is what one piece of it you're going to hear this morning.
Well, let's start with a couple caveats. We're going to talk about EKG education here. This is going to be a multi-part episode series. The MCHD EKG Manifesto was the best name that I could come up with for today. And before we even get into this, please, we're not trying to dumb anything down, number one. Number two, we're not minimizing the need to understand EKG basics, rate, axis, intervals, ST segments. We're going to talk some on an upcoming episode about occlusion MI, non-occlusion MI, and the STEMI paradigm and the push and the pull there. We're just going to reverse the discussion. And really the inspiration came from our most beloved series that we've had on the podcast so far, and that's the Serial Killer series. And what we did was we took the undifferentiated patient and the main patient complaints, and we reversed the discussion. And I want to do the same thing. I hope we can do the same thing with EKG interpretation. And instead of starting with all these minutia basics, non-patient oriented intervals and axis and rate and rhythm, let's take the EKG patterns that we can't miss, the serial killer patterns and the serial killer diagnoses that we need to recognize from the EKG, and start there and work our way backwards.
Yeah, because I think a lot of times, Casey, we look at it in emergency medicine, all providers, whether you're a medic, whether you're a nurse, an APP, a doc, we're all trained in this to look at the ECG with the same singular lens of ACLS. And so I think that can lead to some early anchoring bias, and we think of everything in the series of, is this an ST elevation occlusive MI, rather than how's the patient presenting. So what in this series we're going to try to look at the ECG from a different lens, starting with the undifferentiated patient, which is how we get our patients.
So it's going to be a framework. We're not going to ever make a decision, or at least very rarely, I would say, making a decision on an EKG only. That's a key piece before we go further. The EKG has to be paired with the patient, their history, their medication list, their chief complaint, their age. And we're not getting every EKG for an ACLS chest pain patient, just like you said. But before we even get to whether or not we should obtain a 12-lead EKG, where is our focus first in emergency medicine and EMS medicine?
Yeah, we've talked about this a ton on the podcast, right? We're in emergency services, EMS medicine, and emergency medicine, we're in the death and disability business, right? So our primary focus should be on establishing stability before we go any farther. And how do we do that? We identify those signs of hypoperfusion, the agitated patient, diaphoretic, Shockey, altered mental status, tachypneic, right? We've all seen this. We can describe it. And what do we do when we identify these sick patients is we, here at MCHD, we've talked on another podcast, we deploy the MOOS bundle. That stands for, it's just an algorithm that we came up with to remind us of those really essential tasks that we have to deploy pretty in real time to patients before we move them to establish stability. So it stands for M is monitoring, O is oxygen supplementation, ventilation support, V is vascular access and vascular support with fluids, E is epinephrine, push dose pressors, deploying norepinephrine, epinephrine, and S is sugar and sedation plan. We always check a blood sugar on these unstable patients, and do we need to have some type of restraint sedation plan to move the patient safely. So first and foremost, we have to establish stability, act, and get that safety net set up. Then we go back and start getting through the case, right? What's the patient's chief complaint? What are they here for? What's the story?
Maybe even before we get the 12 lead.
Yes, absolutely. But this is all before it moves. You notice there's no 12 lead in there. We're establishing stability. Then we're going to get the story and try to put the 12 lead into the context of what is the patient's presenting complaint.
So the next question, after stability, we've set up our safety net, we've assumed the patient is appropriate for a 12 lead, and it's going to be a part of our decision-making process. Now we have to ask ourselves, we've obtained the 12 lead, we've got it. The patient's presented with a wild array of possible complaints where we might get a 12 lead in EMS or in the emergency department. The most important question from my standpoint, if you take one thing away from this episode, is we have to ask ourselves, is the primary problem cardiac in nature, or is it an underlying medical problem that's straining the cardiac system, whether that's ischemia, arrhythmia, combination of both? So is it subacute or is it acute? Did it start 20 minutes ago? Did it start 2 weeks ago? Did it start 3 days ago? And when do we get EKGs? Well, we get them primarily. The majority of the EKGs that we get are going to be related to concerns for cardiac ischemia. That's going to be our chest pain patients, our shortness of breath patients, combination of the two. And yes, I realize there are other atypical ACS symptoms, but for discussion's sake, primarily chest pain and or shortness of breath. We'll talk about STEMIs, occlusion MIs, non-occlusion MIs, and the changing paradigm there on an additional episode, so hold that thought. But there are other reasons we get EKGs besides chest pain, just like we opened the episode with. Palpitations, syncope, near syncope, general weakness, altered mental status, overdose. Those overdose sort of psychiatric combo patients. So we're going to make some divisions for the sake of clarity and discussion and to try to divide these episodes up. These are not hard and fast divisions. These are just the divisions we made up. So if you got problems with it, you try to divide it better. Send me some suggestions and maybe we'll re-record these. But we're going to present this in a three-episode package, the MCHD EKG manifesto. And today's episode, we're going to talk about syncope patients and altered mental status / toxicology or overdose patients. On our upcoming two episodes, we're going to have a division for rate, palpitations, and or generalized weakness, so the Tachy-Brady division, and we'll finish it up with cardiac ischemia. Yes, there is significant overlap between syncope and fast and slow rhythms. So we're going to try to keep the rhythm piece, the active arrhythmia, out of today's discussion, and we're going to flip that into episode two. So to do that, I want to take it back to the very first MCHD paramedic podcast episode. If you want to listen to someone who felt like they had an elephant sitting on their chest, I don't know that I've ever been more nervous trying to talk about syncope into a microphone with absolutely zero experience. Go back and listen to episode one. But the gist of episode one is the CRAPS mnemonic for syncope. And this is one that I've used and I'm thankful to have been taught. And it helps you recognize the serial killers in syncope. What are you talking about, CRAPS, doc? Cardiac structural abnormalities, so valvular rupture. So cardiac structure being C, ruptured stuff being R. what, ruptures, AAAs, ectopics, depending on your patient population, age, and sex. If you have a ruptured ectopic or a ruptured AAA, you can pass out. We're going to skip the A, that's arrhythmia. That's going to be the gist of today's episode and the next episode. What's the P? Pulmonary embolus. What's the S? Subarachnoid hemorrhage. So we're going to not focus on cardiac structure, ruptured stuff, PE, or subarachnoid today. We're going to focus on arrhythmia. Now, not an active arrhythmia, because that's the next episode. Today, we're going to talk about an arrhythmia that's not persistent, that's not present when you arrive. The patient shows up, they've got a complaint of syncope, you get their vital signs, and their blood pressure is 120, their heart rate is 65, and they say they passed out. So that's the resolved arrhythmia, potentially, with residual findings you have to recognize on the EKG.
Right. So I love the Krapp's mnemonic. I look at this and teach it in I take that in a little bit different way. Is when Dr. Patrick went through that mnemonic, there's lots of killers in there. And there's historical clues and clinical clues from the examination that lead us down that diagnostic pathway to PE, to subarachnoid, to some ruptured stuff, to cardiac structural abnormalities. This one today, we're going to talk about done passed out, now perfectly normal vital signs, as Dr. Patrick said, normal blood pressure, right? There's only one serial killer in that one, and that is some type of arrhythmia, and we're going to look at the ECG from that lens or start from that lens in syncope. So I think first and foremost, how do we start off? When we have a patient, if we're talking about syncope that passes out, what's our first question there that we always ask?
Syncope versus seizure is my first. Yeah. Do we have tongue lesions? Do we have loss of bowel or bladder continence? Is the patient on Keppra or Dilantin or Depakote or Lamictal or Vimpat or insert any of the new seizure medicines that I struggle to keep up with? Alcohol withdrawal, benzo withdrawal, substance use and abuse history, those things all come into play. Eclampsia would be another that you'd want to keep on your list, obviously. So first and foremost, is it really a syncopal episode or is it a seizure? And we can talk about that probably for another 2 hours. Then I move into Krapp's and think, is there a ruptured valve? And that's going to be a blowing, just enormous murmur. I think I've probably had one of those in my career that I've caught. Ruptured stuff. Do you have belly pain? You know, when was your last menstrual period? Are you a 65-year-old smoker? Are you a 22-year-old with the last menstrual period in that 5 to 6, 8 week range? PE, was there any chest pain before or after? Any shortness of breath? Think about the calves. Think about PE risk factors. And then subarachnoid, acute onset headache, generally not normal when we find them. It can be, but most of the time they're going to be somewhat altered if they have subarachnoid blood. So syncope versus seizure first, then Krapp's. Now we've moved on to today's episode. So let's push all that out of the way. Normal vitals, relatively normal. No syncope plus to take your teaching route. No CRPS from the Krapp standpoint, and the arrhythmia is not there currently. So we're looking for residual findings on the EKG that point us towards an alarm bell that could have been a paroxysmal arrhythmia before we arrived, causing the syncope episode.
Right, mic drop moment. This is not looking for ST elevation MI, right? ST elevation MI does not cause collapse. The ventricular tachycardia caused by the ischemic ST elevation MI does cause collapse. So what are we looking for in these ECGs? We're not looking specifically for ischemia. We're looking for other things associated with collapse, like the QT interval, right? Greater than half of the R to, distance of the R to R or greater than 500 milliseconds in the QTC is kind of the number. The number's kind of all over the place. I use 500 or greater than half the R to R in the setting of a collapse where I become worried. A QRS duration greater than 100 milliseconds or abnormalities with the PR interval, upsloping delta waves, and we'll put some pictures of these things in the show notes in different waves and patterns on the ECG that would lead us to think, this may have been a dysrhythmia that's now resolved. So they're the subtle signs on the ECG that lead you down that pathway of, aha, this may be some type of dysrhythmia causing this collapse.
So you started with intervals, QTC, QRS, PR, good place for your eyes to go. You led into waves. So there are some specific waves in a syncopal patient that we have to look for. Delta wave, NWPW, the upsloping short PR interval, upsloping QRS complex. The epsilon wave didn't really exist in my education way back when. Probably did exist, but I missed the day that we...
I miss that one too, doctor.
But it's not entirely uncommon. The epsilon wave is present in arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia. If you look in V1 and V2, you see a tiny positive deflection at the terminal portion of the S wave and the QRS complex. Picture's worth a thousand words. Check the link in the show notes. And then Brugada syndrome. We're not going to go into Brugada subtypes and the many variations in Brugada syndrome. Just the, I always think of the saddle horn deformity, the saddle horn pattern, also in V1, V2, V3. So if you think about epsilon waves and Brugada syndrome, the similarity there for the take-home point is that that's going to be a bizarre-looking ST segment.
Yeah, you'd be like, is this a STEMI? No, this is not a STEMI. It's a weird-looking right bundle that looks like a saddle.
And it's going to occur in a patient that passed out, not in a patient with chest pain necessarily. So intervals, waves. There's going to be a pattern here, and we're going to hit a serial killer five things to remember. So intervals, waves, left ventricular hypertrophy is another. This is one where I have to eat a little bit of crow. I have taught the medics, and every time that I teach them the Cornell criteria for recognizing AVH, I get grief over here.
What is that?
I get grief from this guy, and he says, don't make it so complicated. If the QRS complexes are touching each other, it's LVH. And so I rolled my eyes and said, I think you can remember, 11 millimeters or greater in AVL. I think you can remember, adding V1 to V5 or V6, V2 to V5 or V6 in the tallest of the two, 35 millimeters.
Is that on Wednesday when I'm standing on one leg? And I
don't think it's that hard, but we'll link this one in the show notes. Siemens sign was published a couple years ago, and the idea of kissing QRSs is as accurate or potentially even more accurate for diagnosing LVH as any of the millimeter-based diagnostic criteria. So not only do kissing QRSs make this guy over here happy, he also was right. So when
there
we
you
see
have it. The one time on the podcast, I've actually, every dog has his day. So there you have it. You're watching the episode where I was actually right about something. Good.
back to reality. And that was pretty funny find for me on one of my journal feeds was finding this article. And again, we'll link it. But when you see LVH, it may not be abnormal. If it's a 59-year-old dialysis patient on hydralazine, clonidine, metoprolol, lisinopril, Cozaar, amlodipine, hydrochlorothiazide, insert all the blood pressure medicines, then that LVH is chronic. That's from long-standing uncontrolled hypertension. When you're looking for LVH and when LVH should be an alarm bell is in a 20-year-old that has exertional syncope that's on no medications. That's not normal. That's an abnormal situation, and so we should recognize that. We should even be looking for that before we even get the 12 lead in that adolescent that passes out that's now back at baseline. So intervals, waves, LVH, Brugada, and then arrhythmia. So if you take those, you've got five serial killers for syncope. Let's walk through them one more time. Take them through each one of those diagnoses and which EKGs patterns they should be looking for. Let's review that one. So the number one, probably the most common, is going to be hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy. That's LVH and kissing QRSs. Pretty straightforward. Which waves are we looking for?
delta waves, the epsilon waves in the right ventricular dysplasia patient. We look for the intervals, right? What is the QT interval? Greater than half the R to R or greater than 500 milliseconds QTC. We look for the Brugada patterns. That's the kind of right bundle branch block. You're like, oh, looks like a STEMI, but the patient's not really presenting that way. They're presenting with collapse. And then arrhythmias, stay tuned.
So we don't want to minimize the fact that when we have a syncope patient, our serial killers, the fifth one is arrhythmia. Bradyarrhythmia, tachyarrhythmia, those can cause people to pass out and absolutely be a killer, whether that's third-degree block, sick sinus syndrome, unstable, stable VT, you name it. We can go down the list, and we're going to talk about that in the next episode. But if you want to remember five, when you see a patient that passes out, think about HOCM / LVH. Think about your waves, Delta and Epsilon, V1 and V2, pretty convenient. Think about your intervals, QTC, QRS, PR for WPW. And then look for Brugada. Think about Brugada in V1 and V2 as well. So that's the syncope portion of the first half of today's discussion. Let's move on to another group of patients that the EKG can absolutely be a goldmine for, and that's our patients that present with altered mental status, that present with found down, that present with not right, that maybe you get the clue that they've got a toxin on board. But let's go back to our altered mental status serial killers, and one of those five is toxins, substances. So when we have an altered mental status patient, toxins have to be on the list, and our EKG is vital. What are we looking for in the EKG in an altered, found down, potential toxin patient?
Yeah, super duper important. This is one I think that we probably miss more in EMS medicine and emergency medicine, and treated wrong, this can be fatal for the patient. So I think some of the biggest clues is their really wide complex tachycardia. So they're really wide complex tachycardia. So it's really one where you're looking at the EKG and you're like, oh my gosh, it's VT, but that's not quite fast enough to be VT. It's 110 or it's 120. Last one I saw was around 130. It was an altered mental status patient. Had a toxin feel to the case that was presented by the paramedic to me. Sorry, we're here on the podcast. We do have to answer consults. Dr. Patrick's going to get this consult. But we'll start with sodium channel toxins, right? Really, really wide complex tachycardias. Think of toxins like flecainide. We've had some flecainide cases here. TCAs are the common teaching in this, but that toxicity is not as common as it was back in the 80s and 90s. Benadryl in high doses can cause us a very common toxin to overdose. Methadone, there's multiple toxins that can affect sodium channel conductivity and produce these really, really wide. So think wide, bizarre tachycardias. I think sodium channel toxins, what is our treatment of choice here? Sodium bicarbonate, and I add in calcium. And the reason for that is calcium really never killed anybody, but hyperkalemia does. And some of these patients are tough to tease out. They're in rhabdo. They may have hyper-K. So hyper-K can present with wide, bizarre, all over the, you know, we get taught, you know, prolonged of the PR interval, peak Ts, loss of the P wave, and then gradual widening of the QRS. But it doesn't always present like that. Sometimes it presents with a bizarre, wide, complex tachycardia in a sick DKA patient with hyperkalemia. Sometimes it presents as a unstable, wide bradycardia or a narrowish bradycardia. So when in doubt, you know, calcium grows great bones and helps your bone structure in your teeth. It does not hurt anybody. That's my go-to. When I give one, I usually give both.
So that's a really excellent overview. I don't have a lot to add other than to think about from the standpoint of the why behind these two. Why do we get wide complex QRSs from sodium channel blockers, that one's pretty easy. It's a sodium channel poison. Why does hyper-K? Well, hyperkalemia is a sodium channel poison as well. So that wide complex comes from the same physiologic base. So I don't want us, medics, emergency physicians, to shotgun treatments, and we have a pretty good idea that random calcium, random bicarbonate in cardiac arrest is potentially not useful and even harmful. But in patients who are altered, in patients who are potentially unstable, in patients who may have ingested a substance, and really any substance, not just TCAs, as Dr. Dixon mentioned, there are so many other common substances that are sodium channel poisons as well. It just doesn't hurt to start with some concentrated sodium and or some calcium, depending on whether you think this is hyper-K or whether you think it's a toxin. And here's the real kicker, and I've absolutely ripped this one from Dr. Amalmatu. We'll link the YouTube talk on really, really wide complex tachycardias so you can avoid his, what he calls a clean kill. And that is, if you take those rhythms, those 120 really wide complex tox patients, and you give them the ACLS algorithm and you play your cards ACLS perfect, what are your medication options? You got three of them.
Right. You give them lidocaine, you give them amiodarone, you know,
Procainamide in the
emergency department, right? You're potentially going to put them into a more unstable rhythm, right? Those all have effects on blocking more sodium channels on multiple channels and can cause a clean kill, right? And so I'm not suggesting, and thanks for, I think, really reiterating that. I'm not suggesting we shotgun anything. We are not shotgunners here with NEBS anymore or all these other treatments. We're talking about a focus where patient has altered mental status, toxins are way up on the list on your differential, so that the story sounds like it may be a toxin, the patient presents their clinical exam like it may be a toxin, you have instability, you have this really wide complex tachycardia, you should consider calcium and bicarb first. That should come to the forefront of your brain, instead of looking, if we look at this tox patient, this altered mental status patient, in the lens of ACLS, the ECG lens of ACLS, we could potentially hurt them.
I'm going to hit a couple more review points and we'll wrap it up. One of the keys here is to really hone in onto the medication list. We had a recent case that we reviewed here in the office that was a very bizarre and difficult EKG, and the key was in the med list. The patient was on Flecainide. So think about the sodium channel blockers, the TCAs, and while they're not the most common antidepressants anymore, we still use amitriptyline for sleep and for migraines. So look for amitriptyline, nortriptyline, the TCAs. They're the common test question answer. Probably not the most common meds, but they're still out there. A lot of the antipsychotics, Seroquel, Risperdal, Abilify, are on that list. Diphenhydramine or Benadryl, large doses of Benadryl. I've seen some really nasty wide complex arrhythmias with bad Benadryl overdoses. Methadone, propranolol, beta blocker, dirty beta blocker with sodium channel blockade properties. So they're going to be VT looking a lot of the time, but they're going to be slower than classic VT, right around that 100 to 120. And that really wide should be an alarm bell. Secondly, look at your patient. Do a good exam. When you find that patient that's down and altered, if you see a dialysis fistula in their upper extremity, you see a dialysis catheter from their chest wall, that should be a real key that hyperkalemia could be on the list, because maybe they missed dialysis. Maybe they're septic and they missed dialysis. So don't let the exam findings escape you. Look for those dialysis keys, those dialysis clues. And once you see that patient that found down and that altered presentation, hyperkalemia should scream up the list. So in these patients, the treatment's going to be moves. These are unstable, altered patients, unstable overdose patients, sodium and calcium, not amiodarone or lidocaine. And that leaves us with our tox altered mental status serial killers. Now, we've got our altered mental status serial killers. We've got seizure, stroke, substances, sepsis, and sugar. But within that tox category and the tox alter patient where we're looking at the EKGs, where should our eyes go? Number one, to the QRS complex. Is it really wide? Should be a clue. Do you have peak T waves? Is there an unstable bradycardia? And those are the three entryways into our hyperkalemia protocol. Do you have a tachycardia? And in an overdose situation, we think about some pathomimetic overdose, thyroid storm, sepsis, alcohol, benzo withdrawal, and then look for the QTC. And when it gets really long, what are we at risk for?
Torsades.
Right? Torsades and magnesium. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of framework for how we're going to look at our syncope EKGs, how we're going to look at our altered possible tox, possible hyper-K EKGs. We're going to have a lot of show notes links here because pictures are worth 1,000 words, and we're going to have hopefully some spots where you can listen to this, go back and look, maybe listen to it a second time and drill it in. So let's take it home. What's the first key? No matter what patient we're taking care of, when we're thinking about getting that EKG, what do we have to do even before we get it?
We got to establish stability, right? So we deploy the MOOS bundle, full monitoring, oxygen, ventilatory support, V is vascular access, fluids for blood pressure support, E is epinephrine, push dose pressors or norepinephrine, whatever your presser of choice in your service, and S is sugar. Always check sugar in these folks, and sedation plan if needed.
Why are we getting the EKG? It seems like a silly question. Maybe something that, why are you even asking me that? Our lens is going to be different whether we're looking at an alter patient, a syncope patient, or future episodes, a patient that's heart is racing or is lightheaded, or a patient with chest pain or shortness of breath. So why are we getting the EKG in our lens? Our differentials should change based on why we're getting those EKGs. Let the differential adjust that lens. Don't forget your CRAPs, syncope killers, cardiac structure, big old murmur, rupture valve, other ruptured stuff, AAA, elderly, hypertensive, diabetic, smokers, pain to the back, ectopic pregnancy, young females, missed period, peritoneal signs, rigidity, tachycardia, hemorrhagic shock, PE, shortness of breath, chest pain, and then subarachnoid hemorrhage, acute onset headache, very altered most of the time, really out of the blue, ruptured aneurysm. And then the arrhythmia, divide that up. Is there an active arrhythmia? Then fairly obvious, you're going to see a heart rate of 30 or a heart rate of 230. Hopefully we don't miss those. But within the syncope serial killers, there are patients who have resolution of the arrhythmia and residual EKG findings that we can't miss. Those are, take us through those.
Right. Don't forget the done passed out. Now normal physiology and a normal appearing EKG, what are we looking for? We're looking for kissing QRSs in hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy. Think about those waves, that upsloping delta wave, short PR interval, the epsilon wave, and we're going to post these in the show notes. Look at the intervals, look at the QTC, greater than half of the R to R, or greater than 500 milliseconds corrected. So we think of that for potential. Did that patient have an episode of torsades, brugada? It's kind of the right bundle branch block. Ooh, is this a STEMI saddleback? We're going to put some photos of these in the show notes for you.
And then arrhythmia. And we're saying for this episode's sake, that arrhythmia is resolved.
It's resolved.
For the next episode, the arrhythmia will be in place. Serial killers for your tox lens. Think about wide QRS, peak Ts, and bradycardia, our hyperkalemia concerns, tachycardias, some pathomimetics, withdrawal, sepsis, thyroid, and then in those patients, look for your QTC as well, because depending on your toxin, if you prolong that QTC, you can be at risk for, again, torsades, thinking about magnesium and or electricity. So as always, we're running up on our 30-minute time limit. We don't want to keep y'all too long. We appreciate you listening. Please subscribe wherever you listen. Leave us a like or a review, 5 stars only, or send us feedback and we'll try to get better. Hopefully this is a framework, maybe nothing new, but reorganized, and sometimes that's just as important. Thanks for listening. We appreciate all y'all out there. We'll be back with a new episode soon.
This podcast was brought to you by the Montgomery County Hospital District, Texas. Production and editing by Andrew Adams. Questions or comments, which are always welcome, can be sent to podcast@mchd-tx.org. Make sure to subscribe above to keep updated to all our future casts. Music, copyright, Kevin MacLeod, and Compitech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0.